Welcome to another edition of the Law of Code podcast.
Anything mentioned in this episode by Jacob Robinson or his guests is not legal advice or investment advice. All opinions are Jacob's and his guests alone. Nothing discussed today should be relied upon for legal or investment decisions. This show is solely for information and entertainment purposes only. Jacob and his guests are not your lawyers, nor are they investment advisors. Please work directly with a lawyer or investment professional.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Law of Code podcast. I'm excited to share this conversation with you today around a novel update that we've seen from Uniswap, where they're looking to turn on the fee switch. So they will be paying back stakers of their UNI token. And here with me today is Stefan Daniel. Stefan is a partner at DNA Partners, an independent law firm dedicated to tech and blockchain entrepreneurs in France and the EU. Stefan advises high-tech firms with their structuring, fundraising, and M&A transactions, and was notably involved in the first legal structuring under French law of DAOs, and he regularly advises companies on equity, debt, token, or hybrid financing and fundraising and M&A transactions involving blockchain companies. Today, we'll talk about the legal implications of the Uniswap fee switch. We'll also talk about Curve's model and why it's a bit different. And then we'll talk about more than the tokens. We'll go beyond and look at the protocols underlying the tokens and see how they can navigate MiCA, as well as outline some major changes that protocols and projects and participants in the ecosystem should be aware of. So it's going to be a wide-ranging conversation. It will be quite technical, but I'm really looking forward to it. Stefan, thanks for joining me.
Hello, Jacob. Thanks for having invited me. Really happy to join this podcast. I'm used to listen to it, so I'm really looking forward to this conversation with you.
Me as well. And we've had a few conversations before hitting record, and makes me really excited about where we'll go for this. And I like the specificity that we're getting into. I think it's really valuable for people, especially those not practicing in the EU, but also those that are in the EU and will be subject to these rules, to get a better sense of where the market's at and what other lawyers are thinking. So let's start really at the biggest sort of draw today. It's the legal implications of the Uniswap switch. So on February 23rd, we saw Aaron Cohn, the governance lead for Uniswap, submit a proposal to upgrade the scope of Uniswap protocol governance. One of the ideas was the use of a fee mechanism to reward UNI token holders that have staked and delegated their tokens. On March 6th, so a couple days ago, the Uniswap Foundation proposal passed the temperature check. So this was just a snapshot poll to gauge initial Uniswap community sentiment, and that was almost 100% of delegates voting in favor. An on-chain vote will now follow, and I believe it was supposed to be posted by March 7th, but I hadn't seen anything about it. So until now, Uniswap had no protocol fees on, meaning all fees were only paid to liquidity providers, and some posited that this was due to regulatory concerns, particularly in the US, where return and yield to holders might be considered more security-like, whether it's the form of dividend or otherwise. And Gabe Shapiro actually had an interesting note online saying that Uniswap's token is equally likely or unlikely to be a security under both scenarios because Howey profits can occur without dividends, which is true. And you noted, though, that under French and EU law more broadly, the distribution of dividends, so revenue payouts deriving from underlying activities, would likely qualify the token as a share or stock security. Therefore, following this fee switch, Uniswap token holders and the token itself might be at risk within the EU. Could you just expand on this? I'll hand the floor to you. What are the legal consequences under EU law prior to MiCA and under MiCA now with a fee switch turned on like this?
Yes, sure. So this evolution is very important for the Uniswap ecosystem. It's also an evolution that we see a lot currently with this tendency of going like real yield programs where you have DeFi protocols sharing revenues. So it's not only important for Uniswap, it's important for the whole ecosystem. The fact that the biggest DEX in the world is doing it may literally accelerate this tendency. It means that for us lawyers like you and myself and other participants in the ecosystem will be asked a lot whether this is feasible or not. So that's why actually I looked into it quite deeply. And so I will answer it through the lens of French law, of course, in which I'm qualified to opine on, and expand a bit in EU law, because EU law is harmonized throughout the different countries. with respect to securities, it's harmonized with respect to crypto assets tomorrow with MiCA. It should be the same everywhere, right? In the 27 countries. So if I take the angle of French law, the French Financial Market Authority, the IMF, published many doctrines and positions in which it said that it would always take a substance over form approach and look at the utilities and the characteristics and the rights embedded in the token. And they said in those publications, whether anytime you have characteristics that look like security, so a financial instrument could be debt, could be shares, could be investment funds, could be derivatives, then the Financial Market Authority could requalify it as a security. So for now, it didn't happen, right? Contrary to what happened in the US, with the SEC going after many DeFi protocols and even NFT projects, even centralized exchanges offering earned programs, etc. But in France, we have this. So in theory, this is possible to obtain a requalification. Then if we expand a bit, the European Financial Market Authority, the ESMA, is currently consulting the sector about how to define and to distinguish security tokens and crypto assets. For the first one, they are under MiFID. In the second one, they are under MiCA, right? In this paper, they say an attached right to profits may lead, according to the majority of national competent authority, to requalification. So the question is really is, if we have a DeFi protocol allowing a fee switch like Uniswap, whether doing so will make the token security. So that's the main question, one that we look a lot into in our practice. So I think there is a lot of self-regulation in the ecosystem. Basically, every time a DeFi protocol wants to do it, they go to a lawyer, they go to a jurist and ask for some advice. And I think for now, most people have been very cautious with it and very few protocols are doing it, right? I know that Paraswap, for example, is doing it, but this is the only one I can name of other than Uniswap. The thing is, if you look at it, distributing the revenues of an underlying activity may be qualified as distributing dividends, very close also to distributing interest, to distribute revenues to the holders of units of investment funds. So the question really is, what is happening if we are in front of a decentralized protocol, first? And second, whether the staking mechanics changes some things or not. Because, of course, when you are a shareholder, you don't need to do anything to receive dividends, right? If you are a bondholder, it's the same. You just have to hold the bond and you don't do anything with it, and you receive the interest. In the present case, you have a token that per se doesn't give you anything. But when you read the Uniswap forum, you have to stake it and then you have to delegate to obtain access to the yield. So maybe this makes a difference, but again, maybe not. So this creates a requalification risk on the UNI token. And I would say in the US, maybe the UNI team hasn't looked into it, but in the EU, the thing is that centralized exchanges that will get the MiCA license will need to look into it. And they will need to ask themselves whether the UNI token for them is a security or not on that basis. And in such case, they will need to delist it. So the practical consequences are very far, actually, very broad. Again, I think the risk of having a regulator going after Uniswap in the EU is very low, right? First, they don't have the resources yet to just cover and instruct all the requests for authorization and licenses they are getting. So I think the risk is very low for the moment. Still, centralized exchanges will need to look into it because they have a license. So they need to operate in accordance with laws, right? And second, if something very bad happens and a regulator or a judge wants to go after a member of the UniDAO or like the founders of UniDAO or the contributors to UniDAO, maybe this is a regulatory surface they could touch upon to go after those people, right? So if there is a very big problem like we had for UST, for example. So I'm not saying this is a risk that will happen. I'm just saying it's a risk that exists. And we as lawyers, to inform the founders of those DeFi protocols just to be cautious with it. But in the end, of course, there is the theoretical risk. In practice, though, I still think it's pretty low for the moment. but we never know. So this is a risk that needs to be taken into account.
It definitely is. And in Canada, there's the governing, not really a governing body, but there's a body called the Canadian Securities Administrators, and it's made up of participants from the 13 provincial securities regulators. We don't have an SEC that runs everything. We have different groups throughout Canada. And so they come together and they typically issue guidance that doesn't have the force or effect of a statute, but is very helpful in interpreting and seeing where the regulator's perspective is. And in 2018, they released Staff Notice 46308. And what that said, there was actually one quote that I wanted to pull out. And they talk about that they would like to note the following, and that's, they may consider a token is a security despite the fact that it may have utility, because it continues to have a number of factors that are security-like, such as a profit-sharing interest. And I think many people say the fact that there could be a profit to be made isn't necessarily premised on the idea of dividends, and there can still be an expectation of profit without dividends. The fact that dividends may be promised and some payout or profit-sharing agreement is promised can really not necessarily change the argument, whether it's a security or not, but lend a lot of weight to a regulator's argument.
I totally agree.
Thing in the EU.
Yes, absolutely. Actually, I totally agree. And what's funny is that when I engage on Twitter with other participants, maybe not lawyers, usually the answer I get is, yes, but look, Unisap is decentralized. Or yes, but look, we need to stake and you need to delegate. So of course, this makes it very different from a company or from an investment fund, right? So let's imagine a regulator would want to go after Uni. How do they do it? First, it's not in the EU, right? Then it's decentralized. So of course, against whom would you go, right? Second, is staking really a differentiating feature? So those are questions that are open right now, but I think it's opening the Pandora box that the biggest player is definitely activating the fee switch so expressly. So they are not like putting it under the name of rewards, or it's like straight distribution of revenues in certain instances, right? So they are pretty clear about what is it. So there is nothing to hide here. So it's going to be very interesting to look at what ESMA, because ESMA is consulting, it would be weird to ignore what's happening with Uniswap. So it would be interesting to see if ESMA says something about it. And look, if ESMA says, like, even through just a line that sharing protocol, DeFi protocol sharing fees would qualify the token as a security, then I think it's game over, right? You could not do it. You could not do it because national competent authority, we need to apply it. So it's really open air question. Doing it definitely creates some risks. Importance is to be informed of it, and then it's up to the founders to decide whether they want to do it or not.
And how would a nexus be made to French jurisdiction in this case? Because, and obviously it can be a similar case in the rest of the world, but that would be because, say, there's a token holder in France of Uni who loses money and then goes to the French regulator and says, hey, I lost money, why weren't you protecting me?
That's exactly it. I think you have two nexus. First, the seats or the place of incorporation of the people that have launched the protocol, assuming they still have some control of it or some influence of it. If you look at the last report from Yosco, they talk about influence, or they talk about people having an influence over a protocol. So they are really looking at tight indices, right? So that's the first thing. Here, definitely Uniswap. I think the founders of Uniswap are not in the EU. So here there is no nexus, right? And then you have the stance of consumers, of users, of investors. And those people, yes, they could either, like, if there is like a very big issue and people lose money, usually they regroup, they take a lawyer. And then, so we don't have class actions in France, or at least very different from the US. But you can still have groups of people going to the prosecutor under criminal law, or going and informing the French financial regulator to try to obtain something. When people lose when they lose money, they try to find a way to recover it.
And I think it's similar in Canada and similar in most places in the world as well. I do want to touch on one thing before we get to Curve, which is this idea of decentralization. And I know let's start with Curve. We'll start with Curve and then we'll talk about decentralization and the carve out under MiCA, because I think that's really interesting, the fact that something could be carved out, but then there's not a clear outline of what constitutes decentralization and where a line in the sand is. So just a little teaser for what's coming next. But I want to talk about the curve model. And in the thread between you and Gabe, you noted that the fact that only VE CRV, this is vote escrowed CRV representing CRV tokens locked for voting in the Curve DAO. You noted that while the position is not non-transferable, or sorry, VE Curve enables access to yield and governance. So similar to Uniswap, it enables access to yield and governance. The difference is that the position is non-transferable, and that could make a big difference in its qualification as a security. Obviously, with the caveat that would still remain to be seen if the court agrees with you. Wondering if you could talk a bit more about your perspective around this model, where in one case we have Uni, which is you stake your token and now you get some rewards and now you can pull those profits out, versus Curve DAO, where you can stake, governance, etc., you still get the same rewards. The only difference is the position itself is non-transferable.
That's right. So I think the Curve model, for having studied it in depth for some projects, is pretty interesting. So you have the CRV token, right? It's the same as the Uni token. So you just can hold it, but as such, it doesn't embed any specific rights. So you can just transfer it to someone else. You can transfer it into a smart contract to LP and those kind of things. But if you lock it, you obtain not even a new token, like a VE CRV, which is, according to my discussions with tech guys, not even a token, but a position. And these positions, depending on the duration of your lock, so you definitely forfeit liquidity. You forfeit the ability to then transfer it. Then you get access to governance, which is actually boosted depending on the duration. So you can lock up to 4 years. And then you get, of course, the fees of the protocol, and you get the CRV rewards with a boost as well if you lock for the longest period. When you look at it first, it's not even a token, right? It's a position. So it's really weird to approach it and to qualify it. So that's the first thing. Second thing is that when you look at the definition of what is a security, and especially what we've been discussing about equity securities, so shares or stocks, one of the main elements to qualify such instrument is the transferability. So it's the ability to transfer it. And actually, when you look at ESMA consultation and when you look at MiFID, we talk about transferable securities. So then when you come back to Curve and the VCRV model, it's not transferable. Of course, you could still say, okay, look, but in the VC industry, you still have lockup clauses in shareholders agreement. That's true. But I think that having a position that is not transferable is very different. If we make a distinction between the Uni model and the CRV model, the Uni model, and I've been on the forum and I've been reading the docs, you can stake and unstake at any moment. So in the end, you don't have any lockup. It's just like it's staked, but there is no lockup. For CRV, yes, you have a lockup. And that's actually why certain other protocols are building on top of Curve to allow liquidity. Like Lido, for example, with Ethereum when you stake.
And I really like that you gave the example of working with VCs, and we see in many SAFs and token projects as well, where there are lockup periods spanning, depending on where, a year, multiple years. In Canada, if you're selling to accredited investors, they can't resell to non-accredited investors after a year. I believe the rule is in the US. Why do you see that as making a big difference? Like, where does the lockup fit in terms of, and the transferability? Because like you alluded to, right, that can end after a period of 4 years. And so are you taking the position that the VECR, not taking the position, but are you implying that the VECRV is different than the Curve token because it's a position? And so the VECRV, that might pay out the profits. The Curve token itself doesn't pay out profits?
No, it's because the VECRV is not transferable. And when you look at legislation in the EU, we do talk about transferable securities or securities that are negotiable on the capital market. So forfeiting liquidity, in my opinion, it could be an argument in case of regulatory challenge on the Curve model or other DeFi protocols using the V tokenomics model, and there are many. It could be, I think, a strong argument to say it is not a security. Then you have, so that's for the difference between Uni and CRV, right? But then for the common ground from an economic perspective, you do incentivize people to be active. You incentivize loyalty. You incentivize people being engaged in the DAO. So there is another argument that could be used, is that you're not just sharing revenues or sharing profits. You are, between brackets, buying a service. What is the service is the fact that you have to be loyal. So you forfeit liquidity in the case of the Curve model, and you participate to the governance. So basically, you give your opinion, which may have a value for the protocol when you, of course, you combine all the opinions of everyone and you can make consensus emerge. So I think those are the arguments that could be brought, in addition to, of course, the fact that the protocol is decentralized, et cetera, we've already discussed that.
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect of it as well. Because to me, and I think like you agree as well, there's always risk in these models, especially when you're talking about providing any sort of profits or revenue sharing or just any token, frankly, at all is involved. There can be speculation based on some investments and some expectations of others. But let's go for a step beyond the token, because in MiCA, there's this explicit carve out for decentralized services. And I'd love to hear your perspective on what they mean when they say decentralized, if they haven't actually explicitly defined it yet, where you think that definition could come from. And then I might have some follow-up questions there. But what's happening with decentralization in Europe?
Yes. So MiCA was very much inspired by existing TradFi regulation. So existing TradFi regulation, of course, regulates centralized entities. And so that's the aim and the purpose of MiCA, is to govern centralized entities issuing tokens or rendering crypto asset services. If you fall under MiCA, it's because there is a central point of failure that you need to regulate to protect consumers. The carve out is extremely thin. It's in one of the recital. There is just a few words. Just MiCA is a regulation that's long, 200 pages. And in one of the recital, it says, and I think they must have thought about not saying too much about it, that out of the scope of this regulation for everything that is rendered on a fully decentralized basis. So those terms, those two terms, fully decentralized, are not defined anywhere. There are, at the end of MiCA, so during the last provisions of the legislation, cross-reference to the fact that the EU Commission will need to make a report in the next months about whether there is a need to regulate DeFi. So if you put the two in correlation, it means that soon we will have positions about what does it mean to be fully decentralized and whether it falls or not under MiCA. What's very interesting is that the French Financial Market Authority and the French Prudential and Banking Authority recently consulted the sector about what is DeFi, what could be the regulation of DeFi, and we are starting to see emerging a few indices of what does it mean to be fully decentralized. Of course, I've when we work with DeFi protocols, I have a list of those factors that would need to be taken into account. Of course, it's a case-by-case analysis, but I think the factors you have to look into is first, whether the blockchain used to build the application or the infrastructure of a smart contract is itself decentralized. Second, you need to look at the governance. If it's fully on-chain, it's better. Then you have to look at the allocation of the tokens, whether it's well dispersed in the ecosystem and you don't have the founders having like more than 50% of the voting rights. You need to look at the number of proposals and the number of people voting to see whether the governance is really active. You need to have a look as well at the multi-sig infrastructure. So making sure in the DeFi protocol, you don't have backdoor, you don't have the possibility for founders to extract the multi-sig, to modify the smart contracts and to extract what's in the smart contracts, for example, which could create a custody risk, right? You have to look at whether there is only one front end operated by the founders or multiple front ends, or even if people are can deploy their own front end to interact with the protocol. You have a variety of factors that you need to look into. And of course, when you look at Bitcoin, you look at layer one blockchain like Ethereum, etc. They seem to be fully decentralized, right? So completely out of the scope of MiCA. Question is more about the protocols. When you look at Uniswap or other protocols like Aave, they do seem fully decentralized. But then, of course, it We don't know everything about how they work. It's extremely complex. Regulator may not have the means to look into it. But basically, that's the state of the art that says regulation may be coming. Regulators are consulting. Doctrine is reflecting. And those are the factors that, as a lawyer, I would look into to determine whether or not a protocol is decentralized or fully decentralized or not.
It's such an interesting question as well, too, because if you give a carve out from certain rules, that's typically where incentives go, right? And that's where you see people start to build. And so I do think it's a positive that they're incentivizing decentralization. I think the problem that comes to mind to me is how you can ever define a carve out like this, because sure, you could say, okay, there's no underlying company. Okay, that's fine. But at the end of the day, companies are just created for liability protection, largely in tax purposes. So that way, now all of a sudden, you can shield the underlying participants from certain liability. And so if you remove the benefits of that, now all of a sudden, you're in this gray area where why are you all of a sudden more decentralized? If you take a traditional corporation, shareholders are made up of people from across the world, but we don't think of them as centralized or decentralized. Why? Because they have a legal entity that represents them. In the case like this, you could argue that there's a protocol that represents all these holders of the token as well, too. And so curious your thoughts on like where you think that if you just had to posit a guess on how they can draw that line or what's happening right now in terms of participation with the community in France, in the EU, on having some line, because there's also the idea of decentralization of the protocol itself, where the servers are, where their nodes are, and then there's the decentralization of the token itself.
Yes.
Do you think, are those the main areas they're looking at? Is it who holds the token? Where does this protocol sit? What other things do they look at?
I think they would go through the list of factors I just described before. What's very interesting, though, is that from a theoretical perspective, now we already have the means to stop a DeFi protocol under MiCA soon, right? Just using those discard out and saying, look, you're not decentralized enough. So you're under MiCA. You haven't filed your application license. So now we have to stop your activity, reimburse your users, etc. There are legal grounds to stop a DeFi protocols now. It's definitely possible, right? What's very interesting is with respect to stablecoins, because I'm just anticipating a bit, right, about the entry into force of MiCA. But the provisions governing stablecoins will enter into force by the end of June. And this means that on the market, you would have two types of stablecoins. The ones that are centralized, which needs a license to issue what we call electronic money token, right? And the ones that don't have it. So the ones that don't have it, they need to be fully decentralized to still be issued, to still be circulating. If it's not the case, again, we regulators will have legal grounds to stop them. And what's going to be very interesting is to see what centralized exchanges, again, will do, whether they will delist a USDC if tomorrow from the next day, so like early July, if see. And the team behind it don't have a license, fully blown license to issue EMT, will they be delisted? Same for USDT, sorry, of course, not USDT. We all know that Circle is working on the license. I've never heard anything about Tether, whether they will do the fully decentralized play or whether they will want an EMT license. It's going to be extremely interesting to see what's going to happen. Because for now, most stablecoins are relying on the decentralized aspects of things to be out of the scope of MiCA. So I'm really curious about what will the regulator do.
And stablecoins are something in Canada that the regulators, the securities regulators, took the position that they are or that they may be securities or derivatives. And so that had a big impact on the DeFi ecosystem here, because now all of a sudden, all these DeFi platforms could potentially get roped into basically transmitting securities, right? And then have registration requirements and licensing requirements in Canada. What pre-MiCA has, what was the consensus around stablecoins? Was there talk of regulating them at all, or did this largely just wait until MiCA?
It's really funny, because prior to MiCA, at least I can talk about it in France, we have a legal framework regarding crypto assets since 2018, so it was very early. We have a definition of what is not a crypto asset, but a digital asset. And when you look at a digital asset, in the definition, basically you have two things. You have cryptocurrencies and utility tokens. And in the limb of cryptocurrencies, the legislator had in mind Bitcoin that could be used as a mean of payment, right? And we used to see stable coins as falling into this category, as long as it's not electronic money, because we also have everything relating to payment and electronic right. money. Yeah, e-money actually. So you need to make sure you don't fall into the e-money category. And if you don't fall into the e-money category, then you could fall into the scope of the broader definition of digital asset. Now with MiCA, it will not be possible anymore because we will have three types of tokens, and we're going to have crypto assets, asset reference token, and e-money tokens.
And yeah, now it will be a big part of it. It's going to be interesting to see what happens over the next few years, because I know stablecoins will come into force. Is it June later this year?
Yes.
We'll start to see that. What are you keeping an eye on the horizon in terms of advising clients in the EU, clients outside of the EU who might just be curious? Like, what should people be most mindful of over the coming months?
Definitely the application of MiCA will change a lot. The way the market works, the way the players operate. We are already anticipating MiCA in our legal advice. So all the notes we do are already implementing MiCA, right? Because as I said, in June, stablecoin provisions will come into force. End of this year, everything will come into force. So the market will really change. It's going to be a tremendous change. And if you look at things, issuing a token up until now was almost non-regulated. Tomorrow, you will have to notify the competent regulator. You will need to file a white paper with specific provisions into it. When you raise funds, you will need to use a crypto asset service provider with a proper license. You will need to apply the 14 days withdrawal right for consumers, many other obligations to comply with. So this is just to issue a token. So it will still be allowed, right? I think it's still better than what they have in the US, where because of how it is, they can't even issue a token. So here you can do it. At least we have this, but it's going to be more complex. Then as regards to the secondary market.
Just one question on that, Stefan. When it comes to this provision regarding stablecoins under MiCA and issuing tokens, is there, like, how does the carve out around decentralization play a role there? Because will there be any argument that a protocol issues tokens is decentralized from the get-go?
It's a very good question. I haven't looked into it yet. I think it will definitely be relevant to see if certain projects can start decentralized. And so when they issue the token right from the beginning, right from the outset, they are already outside of the scope of MiCA.
This is why we need points. Maybe this is why we need the point system.
Yes,
and then
definitely.
It'll be, oh, we're already, and then swap the tokens to points. I don't know. That's not an advocate for points on my end. It's crazy what's happened with that. But
I agree.
Okay, that's interesting.
It's super interesting what's happening with on-chain points and whether they fall under the scope of MiCA or not. Actually, I haven't looked at this question, but it's super interesting. So that's for the primary market, so to issue a token. Then on the secondary market, again, a few services were regulated up until now. Now it's going to be all sort of services. So of course, custody, crypto to crypto exchanges, crypto to fiat exchanges, and operating a trading platform. This was what was existing, but now we're going to have all the activities around placement. So when you search investors for an issuer, on the other side, if you take orders from investors, you pass them along to issuers, again, regulated activity. If you give crypto investment advice, regulated activity. If you manage cryptos on behalf of third parties, again, you fall under the scope of MiCA. Just also, there is one services that seems to be extremely broad. It's transfer activity. So every time you transfer on behalf of a third party, you fall under MiCA. So the scope is going to be extremely large. The licenses are going to be extremely difficult to obtain. For now, for example, the fully blown license of the French law, there is only Société Générale, which is a bank which has obtained it. So I think only very few players will be able to remain or to obtain the CASP status. For now, we are a bit more than 100 VASP under French law. Tomorrow, I think it's going to be at least divided by two, right? So that's a lot. And third, and not least, by the way, it's everything that relates to market abuse. So having founders buying their own token, having issuers, I don't know, maintaining liquidity on their own tokens, which are things that happens all the time, right? It's going to be regulated, exactly like listed companies. So it's going to be a tremendous change.
Mm-hmm. And will that be, does that regulation work in a disclosure manner where we'll see disclosures being necessitated from, say, an insider who could be selling certain tokens in the protocol?
I haven't seen yet whether we will have public records as we have in TradFi. However, what I've seen, again, I'm not extremely, I don't know by heart all the rules, right? The regulation is extremely long. But yes, issuers will need to have a record, internal record about insider information. We'll have to take the names of people knowing it, making sure it's not disseminated. So it's going to be definitely, in terms of compliance, it will really a lot increase in complexity. And actually, at my firm, the bet we are making is that crypto will become the capital markets of tomorrow. So it's going to be as complex as capital markets as it is today, right? So today you have listed companies, tomorrow you will have companies with cryptos out there, and it's going to be the same complexity, the same compliance level, of course, about 10, 15 years from now, right? But this is what we see on our side.
It's interesting. I spoke with Commissioner Peirce at the SEC on the podcast prior, and she made a really good point, and it was that, and I don't know if she made it or I made it, but we were talking about this idea where once you allow carve outs from certain rules, that will incentivize even the non-crypto players to potentially go and form a DAO and then just have shareholders who maintain sort of their status through DAO tokens. And now all of a sudden you might have less onerous disclosure rules and it can be cheaper to operate as a business and things like that. If you are to fast forward though, what do you see being the biggest potential hurdle or roadblock or issue that the current projects in the crypto space will have with complying with MiCA? Like, what will be the most costly rule that they have to now comply with?
If we take the three levels of regulation I've just discussed, so issuing tokens, I think this is doable. And I think this is why also we are going to see ICOs coming back and continuing, because issuing a token in the EU won't be a problem. So that's the first thing. For crypto asset services, it is going to be extremely difficult to achieve the level of compliance that is required to operate. To give you an example, to obtain a license in France would take about a year. So during this year, you cannot even operate. So what, if you start from scratch, it's extremely difficult to not operate for a year just waiting for the license, right? So this will be maybe good for incumbent, but for new players, it's going to be very difficult. Then, of course, the price to get those licenses, the one-off price you have to pay to lawyers and consultants to obtain the license, but also the ongoing price you have to pay to maintain your compliance functions. There has been some discussions in France between some lawyers and friends, and the amount that is popping up is like 500K, sorry, a year to operate a VASP. I'm not saying it's the right amount. This is the amount I'm seeing circulating. There was an article that has been published. Everyone was commenting on this, whether it was true or not. But I think, honestly, it's going to be extremely costly to operate a CASP. And then third, for the market abuses regime, for now, it's completely, people seem not to think about it, but it's going to be very interesting to see how it's implemented at issuers level, how it is implemented within centralized exchanges as well. We all know there have been many insider dealing there. So it's going to be super interesting to see how it works. But definitely the second secondary market will be the toughest.
Why do you say that?
Because again, it's like obtaining the license, maintaining the license is going to be super costly. You will need a lot of HR inside, not a lot of resources. And then it just is going to be complex, difficult, right?
Yeah, it will be. And it's interesting. I wonder if we'll start to see a lot more projects emphasize their decentralized nature to avoid these really onerous costs.
Absolutely. I think, yes, this will be one of the consequences. I think we will see a lot of players saying, look, I can't make it. I can't become a virtual asset service provider. So let's envisage the business on a fully decentralized basis. So yes, I think, and it's already the case, right? It's already the case for stablecoins. Many stablecoins are there, are not fully decentralized. They know MiCA is coming and they are working now to become fully decentralized. So yes, actually, you will have the two-sided markets, one that is going to be the centralized market, extremely regulated, and you're going to have a decentralized market, which may expand because of this.
And I wonder the viability of the centralized market too, if you're incurring these enormous costs. And I guess some of the benefits could be similar to what we've seen with the ETFs, where now all of a sudden in registered accounts or other certain institutions can interact with them. Whereas something like DeFi, right, the average person could save an enormous amount of money on a transaction compared to a centralized player who has all these fees that get passed along. So fascinating. There's definitely going to be a lot happening, and I'm sure you'll be busy over the next couple months with everything that's going on. But let's rewind. Let's talk about your first introduction to Bitcoin. I'd love to hear what your genesis block, Stefan, was and where you were first, what your first impression was of digital assets.
First time I've heard about it was in June 2017. Friends of mine launched a project. It's a very big project now. It's called Swissborg. So it's one of the biggest app in Europe to purchase crypto. So the founders are some are friends, especially one of them. And actually, when I saw them launching this ICO back in the days, I didn't know what was a token. I even asked him, what are you selling? Is it equity? No, we are not getting diluted. We're raising funds. This token will be used for this and that. I thought it was extremely interesting. So I stayed connected with them, tried to help them a bit. They also referred to me. At the time, some projects searching for a lawyer. There were very few lawyers in the market at the time, mostly confidential, to be honest, because I was doing corporate M&A in a very big US law firm. And I didn't have this path at all in my mind at the time. I wanted to continue doing M&A, corporate law, big transactions in big firms. And yes, this is the way it started. So we started engaging with the debates in France. Through think tank and associations, especially one of them, which is one of the biggest association gathering banks and insurance. And through this platform, we were discussing and working on the law that then became the first legal framework for digital asset in France. We had our first matters in this respect. I was dealing with them. So it really depend on how big they were. So some of them were too big, so brought them to the firm. Others, I was keeping them for myself, which is allowed as a lawyer in the French law. You can have your personal clients while being in the law firm. And slowly but surely, like the number of clients increased, then there was this, again, this bull run of 2020, 2021. Again, the flow of clients was getting very big. And we thought with my two co-founders, that there was something to be made in the French market to offer a full service of people from big law firm, so with the same professional endeavor and expertise, and create something. So we started three of us, and now we are 11 lawyers and three interns. It's been a super ride, we're super enthusiastic, and I think it's just the beginning. So we are not even 50% of where we want to be. So we will continue to grow and to recruit. And we really believe that blockchain will become something that is unavoidable. And that, of course, maybe everything will be tokenized in the end.
But you're well positioned to capitalize on that. And I think it's hats off to you and the team for building and growing at such a pace, as well as balancing all the legal work that you do. In terms of the crypto space, though, could you describe some of the you mentioned full service firm, like what are some things that your firm helps with?
Yes, so we are currently five partners and soon maybe six. We cover corporate regulatory litigation, labor, tax, and soon IP. So we really do cover all the needs. We are very focused on blockchain. So 85% of our clients are using the blockchain technology. And we advise them on a daily basis about issuing tokens, hybrid financing transactions, structuring for decentralized finance projects, DAOs, issuing NFTs, implementing NFTs as in-game assets within video games. We do a lot of things, registering, of course, projects that want to render crypto asset services. And then also the founders on their personal situation with respect to taxes, when they grow their company with respect to recruitment, all those things. So we really cover like the birth and death of companies and on a like 360 scale. It's super interesting, and we work with very different type of clients. So really starting companies and startups and way more mature and even sometimes unicorns. So it's super interesting.
It is. It's definitely a fun place to be, fun area to be practicing law. And outside of your clients, are there projects that you're particularly interested in or follow or think will be exciting going forward?
I am currently very interested in the restaking activity within the Ethereum ecosystem with EigenLayer. I personally do restake, right? So I think it's very interesting to use those new tools. I'm also afraid of what could happen, right, if something goes wrong, given the amount of TVL they have already, and that will continue to flow. But I think it's definitely a big evolution of what we know for now. So I think this is something very interesting. Then from a more personal level, we have one client we've been advising since the beginning, which is the Morpho Protocol. I'm extremely excited about what they do. I think they are one of the best team in France, like about 20 people building this protocol. It went from 0 to 2 billion TVL. It's now the second largest lending protocol in the world. They are extremely impressive. So this is something I'm on a purely personal level. I'm extremely interested in following and see where they go.
And when it comes to France in general, and one just last sort of substantive question that I didn't ask before, is there anything else in terms of developments, case law? Actually, I think you guys work on the civil system, so it would be a bit different. But are there any other developments that people should be aware of? Just thought I'd check with you in terms of projects in the crypto space that may or may not deal in France.
To be honest, I have to say that there are not so much happening at the case law level. Very few legal decisions, court decisions, ruling on technical issue. So very few now. I think it's going to take some years to develop, as long as you get the time for litigation to start, then to be settled, then the appeal, then for it to become case law. It takes a lot of time. So not so much at court level. It's mostly about regulatory authority level, which are, of course, implementing those higher rules in the hierarchy. So basically the ones set out by the legislator or the ones soon that will be becoming applicable at the EU level. So I think it's more on a regulatory side that you see evolution. But I have to be honest, on a case law basis, nothing much is happening for the moment except one or two landmark decisions. Not so much.
Okay. No, that's great to know. Last question for you, Stefan. And you've gone from big law to building your own firm. Quite a different experience. I can imagine there are some habits you've picked up along the way that have helped you. What do you typically do that has played a big difference in your, or made a big impact in your legal career?
I think it's the ability to jump on new things. Usually lawyers, I would say, we have a big tendency to look out for the precedent, look out for what has been done in the past, look out for the contract we've made for another client to adapt it. And when you're jumping into the crypto space, and I'm sure it's the same for you in your practice, sometimes you have nothing to start from. So you really literally have to start from scratch. This is, and then you have to think about all the laws that could be applicable to the case at hand, right? And then you have to contribute to emerging standards. For example, in terms of DAOs, we've worked a lot about on that topic in 2021. Now it seems that like a standard is emerging with the use, for example, in France of the association to act as the governance arm of the DAO. We were one of the very first law firms to work on it. And it's really nice to see then it being adopted by other law firms or other projects that we don't advise. And I think we should aim to do it, right? We should aim to look at things with a new eye, be agile, and try to make standards in the market for the new occasions when things come again.
Yeah. Last question for you, Stefan. Is there any advice that you'd been given early in your career that made a big impact?
Good question. I haven't thought about it. I think I've not so much counted on others, because usually as a lawyer, you always count on like partners to guide you through, right? In my side, I have the impression that I had to make it on my own, right? That no one really give me a hand to make it. So that's why actually I created my own law firm. So like I created my own path. So I don't really have an answer, like at least a useful answer for you. But I think that each lawyer should look at what they do and what they do like on a day-to-day basis and go for something they really love and they are passionate about. This is why they would be excellent at what they do. I think there are so many lawyers out there doing things they don't really like just for the position, for the social recognition or whatever. And I think life is too short to do something you don't really like, right? So you should follow what you like and be excellent at it.
Yes, sir. I completely agree, Stefan. Thank you so much for the conversation. I really enjoyed that. And I'll link to your Twitter handle in the show notes below. If people want to follow you, want to reach out, you can get in touch with Stefan that way.
Thanks a lot, Jacob. It's been a pleasure discussing with you about all of this.